Welcome to an extra special episode of the Tudor Travel Show. Now, in a moment, I'll talk about the subject of today's show, but I wanted to say, do stick around to the end of today's episode because I have a very special announcement or two to make and I wouldn't want you to miss out. So do stick around and find out just what I've got up my sleeve. So there was just so much material to squeeze into this month's single episode of the Tudor Travel Show that I just couldn't fit it all in. And so, as is sometimes the way, this month we have a Tudor Travel Show extra so you can get your double fix of Tudor love for the month of May. Now today I'm talking to an old friend of the show, Owen Emerson, house manager at Hever Castle. Many of you will have heard me in conversation with Owen in previous episodes of the Tudor Travel Show, and you might have also seen me on film talking to Owen, touring the castle on the Tudor Travel Guide's YouTube channel. Now, Owen recently told me that he had been doing his own in-depth research on the history of the castle and the social history of Hever Castle, starting from the Tudor period and extending through to the modern day. Now, this work is going to be published in a new book that will be co-authored by Owen and the lovely Claire Ridgway from the Anne Boleyn Files. But I just couldn't wait. And I wanted to talk to Owen about just what he had been unearthing along the way. And so this is the subject of today's episode. Together with Owen, we will go gallivanting through time from the Tudor era and, of course, talking about some of the well-known Tudor personalities associated with Hever, right through until the more modern incarnation of the house during the late 19th and into the 20th century. So it's time to go time travelling, folks. Let's go over and catch up with Owen right away.
Hello, Owen. It's so good to be speaking to you again.
Hello there. It's lovely to be speaking to you.
Yes, and of course, we've had a few encounters in Adventures in Time, haven't we, at Hever Castle, both on the Tudor Travel Guide video channel, where we did a bit of filming at Tudor, but also you're a returning guest on the Tudor Travel Show, so welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be back.
And once again, we are going to be talking about Hever. This is, of course, the month of May. It's a very important month in the Tudor calendar, particularly if you're a fan of Anne Boleyn. Our thoughts naturally go to her and what she was going through in May 1536. And I know we've been speaking over the last few months, you've been telling me about some new and original research that you've been doing on Hever Castle. So I thought, what a great opportunity for us to get together and maybe delve into that in a little bit
more
detail.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, no, it's I'm writing a book with Claire Ridgway, the historian, and having a fantastic time learning all about the people and the place, you know, that is Hever. So yeah, thank you for having me on to chat about it.
Well, I'm excited because I know we are going to be talking about Hever, Tudor Hever, but actually you're going to take us forward in time as well and share some of the other key events or other key events related to the castle, right the way up until its restoration, its modernization by the Astor family in the late 19th century, early 20th century.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to have a quick skip through history and look at some of the other key characters that some people might have heard of, but also some actors at Hever that people may not have heard of at all. Mm. and who I had no idea existed until we started doing this research. So hopefully you'll find that interesting.
I'm sure we will. So let's dive on in there. We are, in fact, going to start at Tudor Hever, 16th century Hever. And in fact, at a time which is perhaps really resonates us with us today, because we're going to be talking about Hever in 1528. And of course, in May 1528, 492 years ago, England and London in particular was in the grip of the sweating sickness. And obviously this broke out in London, and it sent courtiers, the king, fleeing in all sorts of different directions to their country properties. And maybe here we can pick up the story of Anne Boleyn and her family at Hever. So can you tell us a little bit more about the events around the sweating sickness and the role that Hever played?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Hever is often remembered as being both the childhood home of Anne Boleyn and also, of course, the famous location where Henry VIII courted her. But Hever actually plays a very crucial role in 1528 when it acts as a place of quarantine, as you say, for the Boleyn family. Now, I'm sure in the age of COVID-19, people could think of worse places to be in lockdown than the beautiful Hever Castle.
Yes.
However, you know, during their time in lockdown, the Boleyns were in fact gravely ill. The sweating sickness was first identified as such during an outbreak in 1485. And there were several outbreaks of the disease throughout the Tudor era. For example, there was an outbreak in 1508, 1517, and then after the outbreak we're going to talk about in 1528, there was another in 1551. Mm-hmm. I'd actually highly recommend Claire Ridgway's book on the subject to those who'd like to learn a bit more about the sweating sickness. She does a really marvellous job of documenting the outbreaks and giving an idea of just how lethal the disease really was. It was a frightening and deadly disease.
It really wasn't it?
It really was. Excuse me. It really was. And unsurprisingly, it had symptoms of great amounts of sweating from a high fever, a great thirst, a redness of the skin, a pounding headache, and breathlessness. There was also this overwhelming desire to sleep. And it was that desire that really makes us see it as a very quick and sudden killer. People seem to drift very quickly from consciousness and often, you know, could die as quick as within 2 hours. It was a really quite frightening disease indeed. Mm. Now, there has been some confusion in the past as to which of the Boleyn family actually contracted the sweat in 1528. And while there's been no doubt that Anne herself contracted it, there has been some confusion as to whether George or Thomas or both were infected. But
can I just ask you, Owen, just for those people who aren't aware, where is the evidence that starts to point towards who was involved and who was affected by this disease?
Our best source would be letters and papers, this huge collection of correspondence and documents that you can actually read all online. It's beautifully digitised. But that really is our best source of who is getting ill during this time. It's a wonderful collection of papers. You know, you've got letters coming in and going out in many occasions. So that's a really, really helpful source. There are others in Chronicles and also in other collections with where letters are held. Mm. But it's really from letters and papers that you can really get a good sense of who is contracting it and also how the court is scattering. actually believe that we can very clearly determine that both George and Thomas were very ill at this stage. Mm. And we know that the first signs of the breakout in 1528 emerge when one of Anne's maids was suddenly taken ill with the sweat. Mm. And Henry leaves court immediately and travels to quarantine at numerous properties, including Walton Abbey. Now, Thomas doesn't travel with the king, but George does. And we can actually locate Thomas at Hever before the outbreak. So it's very possible that he wasn't at court at the time. We have correspondence from Thomas from Hever at the end of May, and he writes to Wolsey regarding the maintenance work he's been overseeing at Tunbridge Castle. Mm-hmm. And he signs off a letter, and I quote, from Hever, Friday before Whit Sunday, which would date it to the 29th of May.
Right.
I have a feeling that Thomas is already at Hever, and we know that before the 16th of June, Anne is taken to Hever as a precaution, and there she develops the symptoms and falls incredibly ill. And it's at this point that Henry writes a rather frantic letter to Anne at Hever when he discovers that she has been taken ill. And it actually sounds from the letter as though this news has been delivered almost in the middle of night, or certainly late in the evening.
Very dramatic, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, and if anyone would like to read it, it's known as Love Letter 8. Mm-hmm. And we believe it was composed on the 16th of June. And I'd highly recommend Sandra Vasoli's work on these letters. She's twice had access to these letters in the Vatican archives. Very jealous.
Yes.
And it really is. And she does such a wonderful job describing, particularly this letter, Henry's panic, and notices how it's strewn with ink and blots and mistakes. And actually, if you look at digitized versions, you can get them through the Vatican website, the archives website. You really can see Henry's concern etched into the parchment on this particular letter. Now, it's also in this letter that we get the now famous gobbet of information that Henry is sending Anne his second best doctor to attend her. Now, this has actually long been a point of amusement, and I've even seen it used to suggest that Henry could only have loved Anne so much because he sent his second best doctor. And it's almost been used as a measure of both Henry's affection and his selfishness. And I think this is slightly unfair. Firstly, I think it's important to note that Henry is both incredibly paranoid about such illnesses, and he also has a greater duty of care to the country to protect himself as the monarch. Moreover, his letter actually makes it clear, and I quote, "The physician in whom I have the most confidence is absent at the very time when he might do me the greatest pleasure." Mm. So Henry's actually sending his second best doctor, Dr. Butt, because his premier physician is absent. Mm. So Henry is actually sending the best doctor he has to Anne. It's actually an incredibly selfless act when you consider that huge swathes of his court is dropping like flies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't really give Henry credit for much. but on this occasion, I do think he's sort of, you know, done the right thing. He knows Anne's ill.
He gets the benefit of the doubt. And also, I don't know whether you can answer this question, but if you read a lot about this period, Dr. Butt starts to appear very regularly in the accounts, in letters. I wonder whether being around at this point marked Dr. Butts out in certain esteem and favour and kind of promoted him in Henry's eyes.
I would very much suggest you're onto something there, particularly because of the good outcome that comes from Hever. Mm. So we know that Henry writes again to Anne at Hever from Hudson, which is now known as Love Letter 9. And this is dated to around the 20th of June. And it's here that we get information about George. He writes, and I quote, "For when we were at Walton, two ushers, two valets de chambre, and your brother, Master Treasurer, William Fitzwilliam, fell ill, but are now quite well. So I think we can safely say from this part of the correspondence that it is George, as well as Thomas, who is with the king, that had the sweat but has recovered from it. And we do get more information about the success of Mr. Butts that comes from other correspondence. So from the 23rd of June, we have correspondence from Thomas Hennage, who's Wolsey's gentleman usher. And he writes to Wolsey to update him on the situation. And it's here that we learn, and I quote, "This morning it is told me that Mistress Anne and my Lord Rochford had the sweat and were past the danger thereof." And we also have correspondence on that day from Wolsey's secretary, Brian Tuck, who writes, and I quote, "How Mistress Anne and my Lord Rochford both have had it, what jeopardy they had been in by turning in of the sweat before the time of the endeavour of Mr. Butts, who have been with them in his return and finally of their perfect recovery."
So, of course, Lord Rochford here refers to Thomas Boleyn. I suppose it could be a bit confusing because eventually, of course, George Boleyn became Lord Rochford when Thomas was elevated to the title of Earl of Ormond. But at this stage, we're definitely talking about Thomas.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You're completely correct in saying that. So when we are learning of Lord Rochford at this point in 1528, we are talking about Thomas Boleyn and not his son.
Do we assume then that it was Anne that took the sweat to Hever and infected her father? Do you think that's what happened?
So I think it is actually highly likely that Anne does take the sweat to Kent with her. And we know that this is how things spread. We've got people scattering to their country seats because it's the best thing to do in terms of their health. They're in a far less populated area. But of course, if you've got it, you're taking it with you. I think it certainly accounts for how these kind of ailments spread during the early modern period. I think we can actually glean further in the record from the subsequent correspondence that actually Thomas is taken really quite badly ill, perhaps much more so than Anne is. So we've heard that Thomas and Anne are recovered. But if we then look at the subsequent correspondence, we can really tell that my Lord Rochford was to have come, but because of the sweats, he remains at home. Indeed, we actually have no correspondence that suggests that Thomas is at court before the 20th of August, when he writes a letter to Wolsey from Penshurst.
Right.
By which time he is then a steward. He has a stewardship of it. But it is assumed that the family are all back at court by late August for the arrival, of course, of the papal legate from Rome. So there's actually quite a long period of time here that Thomas is absent. And it seems that Anne's delay back to court is in relation to the prolongment, of Thomas's recovery, which is quite an interesting detail.
It is. It's a very intimate just window into a relatively brief moment in time, which sheds another perspective on how this virus affected the family.
It is. And, I think we can all glean from the correspondence that all of the Boleyns suffered pretty badly by it, though none, of course, as much as Mary Boleyn's husband, William Carey,
yes,
who, of course, lost his life to the sweat during that outbreak. Hever does act as a safe haven for the Boleyns at a time of great turmoil, and it repeatedly does so. It's again to Hever, time and time again, that Anne returns to seek sanctuary. But I have to say, reading all of this documentation, these letters, during this current crisis, really has made me look at it in a different way, actually. We're constantly hearing of people suffering, losing people. And it really does give you a different lens into what these people went through. These very different illnesses, but they do share some of the same symptoms. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were in a much, much more precarious position.
Yeah, they had no idea what this was about or how to slow it down or what to do to improve the situation.
No government control. No NHS, you know, absolutely nothing. All of the things we take for granted and now rely on.
Yeah.
They had none of that. And it's quite humbling, actually, reading this documentation and seeing, you know, many of Henry's own ushers becoming ill. It really does put it into perspective how quickly and how deadly this virus was. It's quite humbling, actually.
Well, let's move forward a little bit to the other Anne of Hever Castle, and that's
the
lovely Anne of Cleves. And I know you have a particular also love for Anne of Cleves, so maybe you could tell us a little bit more about her time at Hever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she's another Anne favourite of mine. She's a very, very colourful character. And I've really enjoyed researching about Anne of Cleves and her time at Hever. It's been very surprising, and I've found a lot more affection for her by doing so. So after the very quick and dramatic downfall of the Boleyns' tenure at Hever, the castle became the property of the crown. Now, it was once held that the castle was seized by Henry following Anne Boleyn's execution. Mm-hmm. However, we do have particularly good documentation that suggests otherwise. So Thomas Boleyn, by then really a shadow of his former self, quite sad really, dies in March of 1539 and is buried near his son at Henry at the Church of St. Peter at Hever. So Thomas leaves ample provision for his mother, Margaret Butler, to live out her last days at Hever. And she really is the last of the Boleyns to live there.
Do you know what? I remember coming across Margaret Butler, you know, many years ago, but still well into my love of the Tudors, and suddenly having this realisation that Anne had a grandmother who was alive and living in Hever. And I think we tend to forget some of these other characters that lived there around that time. And I think I'd love to know more about her. She must have been quite a character, living to quite a ripe age.
You know, she's another one of these sort of forgotten characters in a way. Sort of her absence from the narrative, I think, almost helps perpetuate this idea that Anne comes from a humble birth. People only tend to focus on the male side of the Boleyn family. When in fact, Margaret Butler is, you know, the co-heiress of the Earldom of Ormond. You know, she's an incredibly, from an incredibly prestigious family. She's from one of the premier families in Ireland. Yeah. You know, she grows up at Kilkenny Castle. So fascinating character. Mm. And she's the last Boleyn of Hever. Fascinating character. The estate briefly passes to James Boleyn, that's Thomas's brother, and he sells it to Henry VIII in exchange for some money and crucially properties in Norfolk in 1540. Now, this is the Boleyns retreating to their family seat, essentially.
Because, of course, they came from the Blickling area, didn't they, originally?
Absolutely. Generations of Boleyns come from Norfolk. They are, I would say now, more famous for being a Kentish family, but they have much, much deeper roots in Norfolk. And James does play a role at court. He certainly plays a role. He sees his niece elevated to queen. But this really is the Boleyn sort of moving back to their family seat after the, you know, dramatic downfall and the death of Thomas. Now, after Henry's ill-fated and brief marriage to Anne of Cleves, Henry really bestows Hever upon her as part of her annulment settlement. Now, contrary to popular belief, Anne never actually owns Hever. She was granted the right to rent numerous properties, including the palaces of Richmond, Bletchingley and Hever, and numerous other properties as well. Properties that she would let out and glean an income from. And the Crown actually pays her rent for these properties.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's an awkward and important distinction. And it really means that the assets remain the property of the Crown. They therefore aren't properties that she could sell or leave to anyone in her will. Mm. Now, this, of course, means that Hever has really rather illustrious ownership during Anne's tenure. It's owned by Henry VIII, Edward VI, Queen Jane for all of 13 days, and then by Queen Mary and King Philip. And Anne pays the princely sum of £9.13.35 per annum to the Court of Augmentation as her rent for Hever. Mm. Now, it does appear that Anne spent much of her time after the annulment at the more auspicious properties, so Bletchingley and Richmond. However, when Anne's status drops from being the king's sister to the king's aunt upon the death of Henry VIII, Edward actually strips her right to lease Bletchingley and Richmond. And it's at this point that Anne appears to begin to use Hever less as a hunting lodge and more as one of her chief residences. So we do have references to Anne being at Hever when she writes to Mary on the occasion of her marriage to Philip of Spain, an incredibly controversial marriage at the time. Anne's location at Hever during the rebellion against the marriage placed her for a time in serious danger. Now, we do also have correspondence from Anne from Hever to her brother also, and there's some lovely little details in there about Hever life.
Oh, that's lovely. So her brother, of course, was Wilhelm. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Ooh,
I'm remembering that from my In the Footsteps research. And so obviously this was the Duke of Cleves now back in her homeland. And are those letters in the archives there? What do we know?
Yeah,
about?
Absolutely. We had a researcher who worked at Hever a few years ago. And she was a native speaker and she was able to translate them all. So we have a lot of translations at Hever of those letters, which is just fantastic. And we get some really beautiful detailing. For example, Anne talks about her love of the honey at Hever, which I think, you know, must mean that she's spending certainly a portion of her time there because she's enjoying the local wares of the area. It's just lovely to get that intimate detail that you don't necessarily get from Anne when she's writing to people of power at court.
So what happens to her there? Is it a peaceful existence at Hever?
Well, for the most part, yes. But I just briefly touched upon there that for a time, Anne is in serious danger. And it's not a danger that she's necessarily aware of. So there is a large rebellion in 1554 known as the Wyatt Rebellion, which is chiefly a rebellion against the marriage of Mary I to King Philip of Spain. And it's perhaps more of a political rebellion than purely a religious one. The rebellion is most famous for its eponymous leader, Sir Thomas Wyatt the Younger, who is based at Allington Castle in Kent. Now, this is only 15 miles from Anne, where Anne is situated at Hever. Mm. And this really is the hub of the rebellion. Time and time again throughout history, Kent is the hub of rebellions because of its location, just off from London. It's lovely to work in quite a rebellious area.
Absolutely.
Of the country.
you rascals, you.
Absolutely. As I say, it was the hub of where this rebellion was going to sort of launch from, but it was to be drawn from across the country. So it was formed from forces from Sir James Croft in Herefordshire, Sir Peter Carew in Devon, and the Duke of Suffolk, Henry Grey, in Leicestershire. Now, of course, this was Henry Grey's second attempt to overthrow Mary, having been involved in the elevation of his eldest daughter, Queen Jane, to the throne instead of Mary. And his actions in this rebellion would seal his daughter's fate. It's quite a tragic little end to James' life. But the chink in Wyatt's armour was his involvement of Edward Courtney, who is the Queen's second cousin. And it's believed that he was to be the candidate to marry the Princess Elizabeth, who would then reign in Mary's stead. Now, Courtney, before the rebellion, confesses to Stephen Gardiner of the plotted rebellion, giving the crown the upper hand. So they're aware that something's going to happen. Right. It's not a surprise attack. Now, this was a rebellion, nonetheless, that could have gone either way. And Mary actually dispatches men to negotiate with Wyatt. And Wyatt would only accept custody of the tower and the queen in it as his terms, which were duly rejected. Now, Mary really shows her mettle in a speech that she gives in her capital at the Guildhall. It's the speech of her life, really, and it clearly demonstrates how able she is to command the loyalty of her subjects. And she declares that she's married to the Commonweal. Very evocative of Elizabeth's statement.
Yes. Yeah, very.
She's married to England.
Yeah, and I was just thinking this is Mary's Tilbury moment, isn't it, really?
It is. And it's so successful. You know, it's a truly decisive moment. It goes downhill quite rapidly for Wyatt thereafter. Mary really holds her ground. She refuses to leave court when she's told to, and eventually Wyatt is captured. So you're right, this is her Tilbury moment. This is her, you know, I'm married to England. And winning the support of the capital is something that Jane was never able to do. Jane was never able to command the capital. Mary demonstrates very decisively that she can do so.
So this puts Anne in danger because of where she's geographically located?
Yeah, absolutely, but also to do with who she is in connection with. So she's quickly implicated in the Wyatt Rebellion during the examination of what has happened that follows Wyatt's capture. Now, according to a dispatch dated the 12th of February, just after the rebellion, 1554, and I quote, "The council has sent two of the Queen's physicians to visit the Lady Elizabeth and find out whether she is unwell or only pretending, and whom she has in her house. And if she is not ill, the Admiral, Hastings and Cornwallis are to arrest her and bring her to the tower. The Queen, moreover, told me that the Lady of Cleves was of the plot and intrigued with the Duke of Cleves to obtain help for Elizabeth. Matters in which the King of France was the prime mover." So, I mean, the next sentence from Elizabeth being arrested, which of course she is, we've got Anne of Cleves as the someone, you know, doing the moving and shaking for Elizabeth.
Say that through my writing about Anne, I find it really hard to believe that anyone would believe that Anne of Cleves would be stirring up trouble, because she seemed one of the kindest, most gentle and submissive person that I think I wrote about in terms of the six wives of Henry VIII.
Absolutely. It's completely uncharacteristic. You know, the worst that Anne of Cleves does is when, you know, Bletchingley Palace is taken from her and is given to a gentleman called Thomas Carden, who we'll talk about shortly. She just decides to turn up anyway, even though she's not allowed to rent it anymore, and sort of dines at his expense and stays there regardless of his ownership of it.
Good old
man. That's the sort of she's a bit cheeky, but she's not the sort of rebellious sort of Machiavellian schemer that she's being painted here. But she is in an incredibly dangerous position at this point. She has a closeness to Elizabeth, and she does have that continued correspondence with her brother. And her proximity to Allington Castle really makes her a key suspect in the aftermath of the rebellion. And there's also this very strange speculation that this is Anne somehow gaining revenge for her ill treatment, having been thrown aside by Henry. Why she would be taking it out on Elizabeth, on Mary, is it, you know, anyone's game? But you really get the sense that all bases are being covered at this point, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They're not leaving any stone unturned. Now, she was also a close confidant of Sir Thomas Carden, who was a member of her household and who takes Bletchingley after she is removed from the palace. And he also is implicated in the rebellion. This is another connection that makes Anne look guilty. So things are, for a time, looking incredibly precarious for Anne. And it actually appears that she has absolutely no knowledge of her suspected involvement, or that she was implicated in it at all.
Right.
Now, no proof is ever found that Carden or Elizabeth were involved, and subsequently suspicion of Anne's involvement abated. However, Anne never regains the Queen's trust or the good relationship that had previously existed between them. We have no documentation that Anne was ever invited back to court after this event. And I think it's actually a really tragic ending to Anne's life, because she just regained her status with the elevation of Mary, and had even been, you know, in a very respected place at her coronation. When she died in at Chelsea Manor in 1557, she does leave funds for the poor of Hever. And I really think we can glean from her correspondence that she was actually very happy there, that she was very fond of it. So it's really sad that this sort of suspicion that was never proven really marred her reputation towards the end of her life. It's a very sad sort of end note.
So let's move on and think about what happens to Hever after Anne dies. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Anne's death is really the ending point of Hever being part of the Crown estate. It's sold by Mary to one of her trusted members of council, Sir Edward Waldegrave, in 1557. Now, visitors to Hever might recognise that name, as we do have a room of that name that has been named so to recognise that family's ownership. It doesn't appear that any of the Waldegraves actually lived at Hever. Or if they did, it was only for a very short period of time. Now, for example, we do have a brass in St. Peter's Church at Hever to William Todd, who died in 1585, who was a schoolmaster to Charles Waldegrave, that's Edward's son, which would suggest that for at least some of its history, we had some Waldegrave presence, or it acted as a sort of retirement home for valued teachers, you know, servants. We're not quite sure. But what is clear from Hever's archives is that much of post-Boleyn existence, Hever is to let, it's let out. So we do have these very big family names. We have the Waldegraves, who owned Hever for 150 years, barely ever lived there. Same can be said from the Humphreys family, and the Wardos and subsequently the Mead Wardos, we have huge periods of time where the castle isn't being occupied by the people who would make significant changes to the fabric of the property. And this is one of the key reasons that we have so much of the Boleyn's original house intact for visitors to see today. Tenants would rarely have the means nor the motive to refurbish a property that wasn't theirs. We do have these big family names. They're not living there. But it's actually to the benefit of us today because, we do have so much of the Boleyn family house. And I'm really, really enjoying being able to explore not only some of the lives of the most famous historical actors associated with Hever, you know, the Boleyns, Henry VIII, Anne of Cleves, also some comparatively modest individuals that are renting portions of the castle as tenant farmers. Now, life was comparatively hard for these farmers, and there are many instances of bad harvests and relative hardship. But we do actually have a murder during this period.
Oh, do you?
Which was, we do. It was quite unexpected. Yeah, one of the tenant farmers met a very grisly end in 1808. His name was John Humphrey Jr. His father had previously held the tenancy, and he was married to a woman called Mary. And we have some rather dramatic reporting in local newspapers that tell us a little bit more about the murder. It reached the news in Bury St Edmunds and in Hereford.
Good gracious.
And I know. And so the former reports on the 8th of June 1808 that, and I quote, "Mr Humphrey of Hever Castle near Edenbridge in Kent was shot on a footpad," that's sort of like a walking road, "of Hever, shot on a footpad on his way from Western Market, is since dead. The coroner's jury have pronounced a verdict of willful murder by persons unknown." Mm. Now, it's believed that the inquest actually was taking place in what is now called the council chamber at Hever. But what is unclear from the records is whether anyone was actually arrested, let alone brought to justice for the murder. Mm. Now, his wife remarried the next year to a local farmer, Henry Rode, who then took on the tenancy between 1809 to 1818. Now, interestingly, we do have a letter in the Hever archives dating much later from 1898, and it's really regarding someone trying to find out about the case. And it very interestingly suggests that Henry Rode, and I quote, "knew more of the matter than he ought." So this is the man who marries John Humphrey's wife.
Okay.
It goes on to detail that the murdered John Humphrey haunts his wife and Henry Rode at Hever to the point where the castle actually had to be exorcised by all the neighbouring clergy with the aid of water from the Red Sea and wax candles, which I think is a lovely little detail.
Oh, my word, yes.
So perhaps, you know, when our visitors report to us that they've felt a chill and they might have felt Anne Boleyn brushing against them, it's not. It's John Humphrey, our former murdered farmer.
are we implying there that he was bumped off by a potential rival in love, maybe?
That's certainly what the letter is suggesting.
Yes. And
I, really frustratingly, I only happened across this murder just before lockdown happened. So I haven't been able to properly get into archives. I've been relying on online information about it. So I'm really hoping we got some coroner's notes even, you know, more local newspaper reporting. But yes, one of the theories that is posited a bit later in 1898 is that a local farmer has bumped him off and married his wife and gained a very nice tenancy at Hever Castle. Yes,
it's not beyond the realms of possibility there. So the castle is rented by tenants, by farming people, but then there is a turn, isn't there, in the castle's history, and we get the Astor family coming in, the very, very wealthy Astor family who really restore the castle. And I just love to know more about that, about the castle they bought and what, how much restoration did they actually do? What actually changed and what is left of the Tudor Hever Castle?
That's a really good question. And so you're completely right. From 1903, William Waldorf Astor purchases the castle and he throws an absolute fortune at restoring it, adding on the 100-room extension that looks like a Tudor village behind the castle, which is now our bed and breakfast, the Astor Wing. And he landscapes the grounds to the standard that you largely see today. It was a huge undertaking. It cost an absolute fortune, not short of $1 billion in today's money.
Wow.
I know, quite astonishing. Now, Astor liked to propagate the notion that Hever was in a dilapidated state when he purchased the castle, but I simply don't think that the evidence that we have backs this up. Now, before, in the 1860s, there was a group of artists who rented the castle. They were called the St. John's Wood Clique. I'd highly recommend your listeners to check out their artwork. It's absolutely beautiful. Mm. And they used Hever as a backdrop to their art. And we can really glean from this period. They're not only painting, but they take photographs. The Hever is actually in a pretty good state at this time. I particularly recommend a painting of a ghost hunt in Anne Boleyn's bedroom. It's painted by William Frederick Yeames. Mm-hmm. And there's also a really evocative and famous painting of Anne Boleyn being arrested at Greenwich Palace by David Wilkie Winfield.
Ooh. Can we look those up online?
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite a famous painting and it uses the Great Hall as the backdrop. And he also painted a lesser known painting of Anne Boleyn being visited by angels, which is set in Anne Boleyn's bedroom. So we got all of this artwork, which of course artistic license has been taken, but we have a very good idea of sort of the proportions of the room and what kind of state they are in. Moreover, we do have photographs which are much more accurate portrayal of what the castle state is in. Now, moreover, there is actually two other periods of restoration before Astor gets to Hever. So in the 1830s, the castle underwent extensive renovations. So what is now the council chamber was elaborately panelled, the floor above was taken out and a balcony inserted to create a new music room for Jane Waldo, who then owned it.
Right.
And indeed, extensive plans were carried out refurbishing the castle at that stage. Then Captain Seabright took lease of the castle from 1895 and carried out many renovations too, less than 10 years before Astor purchased the castle. Indeed, we do have before and after photographs of the castle during this period. And it's quite clear that Seabright's renovations have maintained Hever to a very high standard indeed. Moreover, he actually removes many of the overtly Victorian additions to the castle that Jane Waldo had installed. Now, that is not to say that all of his renovations were welcome at the time, nor frankly remembered fondly today. So, for example, the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings, SPAB, wrote to the Times in 1899 that their offer of assisting Seabright's renovations had been declined, and Thackeray Turner, the Society's secretary, showed particular concern about the maintenance of the ancient Tudor guardhouse. Now, this was the castle's first line of defence. It was situated to the southwest of the castle, and sadly, his concerns proved to be astute, for Seabright sadly dismantled this original either medieval or Tudor feature in that same year, which is a massive loss to the estate.
Can I ask you just a little bit more about that? What was that, like a gatehouse, or what? And would you know, was that on the other side of the moat? Where would that be?
Absolutely. So the closest position, if you can think where the information desk is now, mm-hmm. It was most likely located there, just before the outer moat, and it's one story. Little set of two buildings. We do have it in paintings, and it's really where the guard is located, and that is the first line of the castle defences. So he would stop you, ask you what you're doing at Heber today, and he would sound the alarm if something was up.
Right.
So it's a lovely little feature that I'm rather sad that we don't have anymore.
Tragic.
And
yeah.
Another massive loss was the Tudor stables, which sat in front of the castle, just outside the outer moat. Mm-hmm. This was a double-storey complex with vast stables below, had a staircase up to the second floor with a beautiful open gallery that led to five bed chambers, a 30-foot vaulted chamber where the groomsmen and their family lived. And it's just such a tragedy that this beautiful structure was demolished so late in the day.
Yes.
We do, again, have numerous artworks which show us what the exterior looked like. And it was just a stunning structure. And much to my amazement, I happened across a beautiful sketch of the interior of the barn just last month.
Oh, my goodness.
It magically appeared before my eyes when I was reading an article about Kentish barns. Oh. And it includes all the measurements of the structure too. And you know, I just love research days like that.
Total gem. I know from my In the yes. Footsteps research that when you come across something like that, it's like all your Christmases have come at once.
It really, really is. Yeah, absolutely. Having scolded Seabright for dismantling some key parts of the Tudor estate, it must be said that his efforts, alongside Jane Waldo before him and Astor afterwards, really have helped keep Heber in the just amazing condition that you see it in today. You know, one thing visitors don't always appreciate because of the panelling and maybe the presentation of some of the furniture in the rooms, that you really are walking in the original Tudor house that Anne walked in. It's still there. It's in situ.
Yeah.
You know, if you took all that panelling out, which is essentially just aesthetic, Anne would very much recognise her house. It's, yes. It's quite extraordinary, and it does owe a lot to both those, you know, significant periods of restoration, but also to the fact that Heber is let out, that these individuals, while calling it home, don't have the opportunity to alter much about it.
Yeah, it's one of those little quirks of fate, isn't it, that just saves and preserves. I always think, you know, the same at Hampton Court, that it was the, you know, the outbreak of smallpox and the death of the Queen that saved the remaining half of the Tudor palace so we can still enjoy it today. So thank goodness for those little things. But I agree with you. I know there are some people are disappointed when they find out the interiors of Heber aren't authentically Tudor, but I'm with you, Owen. I think it's amazing that essentially we still have the same building there. Yes, a few of the rooms have been changed in terms of their function, but the house is still there, and I think that's incredible.
Yeah, I do. You know, I do think it's right to recognise the scope of Heber's history. It had a history before it was owned by the Boleyns, and it had a long history thereafter. So it is important to recognise that as visitors go round. But, you know, you really are walking in Anne's footsteps when you visit. There's nowhere quite like Heber. There's nowhere that can claim to be Anne's childhood home. Mm. There's nowhere that exists that has that claim to her happier part of her life. So, you know, when this awful lockdown abates and we return to a semblance of normality, I would, you know, strongly urge people to come to Heber. We're not a charity. We don't receive public funds, so I'm sure they'll very much appreciate or support in the near future.
Don't you worry, Owen. We'll all be stampeding there the moment.
Fantastic.
I'm no doubt about that.
Fabulous.
Oh, well, I just wanted to thank you for giving us that wonderful potted history of Tudor Hever right through till today. Thank you so much for sharing all that research that you're doing. And you're producing a book, aren't you, as you said. So any ideas when we can look forward to that?
Yeah, so we're hoping it will be out sometime next year. It's going to be called Hever, A Castle and Its People. And it's very much looking at Hever from the inside out, as it were, really using the social history of the castle to look at its that impact that people had on the building itself. So it's very much going to be Hever people based and looking at the, the impact that they had on those iconic walls.
Wonderful. Well, we'll look forward to that. And so I think all that remains for me to say is thank you so much, and I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much to Owen Emerson for taking the time to share his research with us. Lots of new and interesting information to get our teeth into there. Now, before we go, I have a couple of really exciting things to tell you about, and both of them involve live chat. I am going to be starting some live chats for you guys. One of those is going to be in my private Facebook group, which accompanies this show, called The Tudor Travel Show Hitting the Road. And you can find the links to that in the description of every podcast that I publish. And so I'm hoping on a weekly basis, on Saturday, I will be going live in that group. I'm not quite sure what we're going to be covering yet. It'll be very much as the mood takes me, depending on what I'm looking at, what I'm researching, what I'm reading about. And also, it depends on you guys. So if you pop along and let me know what you're interested in, chat to me, tell me what's on your mind, then I will also do my best to incorporate some of those things that you're interested in future live chats wherever possible. That's the first one. The second one is a live chat that I'm going to be streaming on YouTube on a monthly basis. Now, I'm aiming for this to be the first weekend of every month, again, wherever possible. This time, however, I'm not going to be alone. So I'm going to be having a very special guest to join me for each of those live chats. And in fact, we are kicking off on the Saturday, the 6th of June, with my guest on this occasion being Professor Glenn Richardson. Now, many of you will know that Professor Richardson was the lead speaker on my recent Field of Cloth of Gold 500 virtual summit. And since the 500th anniversary is actually on the 7th of June, I thought, what a great idea to have Glenn along on a live chat to celebrate the real kickoff for this event. And I will have a very special announcement to make for those of you who missed the sign up to the virtual summit the first time around. So if you're one of those folk and you're thinking, why did I miss it? And you're kicking yourself, kick yourself no more. Just make sure that you turn up to that live chat. And I recommend that you subscribe to my YouTube channel and make sure that notifications are on for new broadcasts so that you know when we are going live. But just to reiterate, the plan is Saturday, the 6th of June at 5 p.m. That is 5 p.m. UK time. Okay, well, I hope I'm going to be seeing you at one or both of those live chats. The first one, remember, Facebook will be happening weekly on a Saturday to begin with at 5 p.m. But for those of you in the Southern Hemisphere, I am thinking of mixing that up a bit and changing the time around so that it suits you guys. And the second one will be the monthly live chat, which is going to go live on YouTube first weekend of each month with a special guest. Okay, there's a lot going on, and I think it's probably time that for now I sign off. But just to let you know, of course, that the Tudor Travel Show will be back in June, and this time we're going to have a bit of a Thomas Cromwell thing going on. So make sure you join me then to find out more about this incredibly fascinating, if not ruthless and somewhat unlikable character. Okay, well, I'll leave it there, and I look forward to seeing you in the live chats or perhaps back here again for the next episode of the Tudor Travel Show in June. Okay, well, until then, my friends, as ever, it is happy time traveling.